Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And remember, you can check us out on Facebook or follow us on Twitter or do both. AWF Union Podcast. AWF Union Podcast. Let's go to New York City right now. And joining us on line number two is Sean Richman. We've had Sean on the show a couple of times. He's author of the book, came out perfect timing here, Sean. April of 2020, Tell the Bosses We're Coming. And this is a prelude of the explosion in organizing. And Sean is currently teaching labor studies at SUNY. That's the State University of New York. Hey, Sean, thanks for joining us here on the show today on such a short notice. We appreciate you filling in. We were going to talk about Trader Joe's organizing, and they closed one of the stores right before they were going to go public with the union campaign. So anyway, how's Sean Richman doing? How we doing, brother?
I'm doing all right. Thanks for having me.
Good. So, you know, a lot of that's going on right now. Starbucks closing stores. Mentioned Trader Joe's. I'm just wondering, is that the standard operating procedure as part of the union busting techniques that are being used today? What's your take on that?
Not standard, because generally an employer wants to have a business.
Good point.
I mean, Starbucks is really going scorched earth here. And, you know, the law has traditionally given employers wide latitude for decisions that are at the core of entrepreneurial management. But this is so clearly retaliatory, and it's such a pervasive action that they're doing. Really, what Starbucks is doing is, you know, they know that the NLRB is going to find against them in all these unfair labor practice charges. And they know that the NLRB is going to take them into court for enforcement powers, because the NLRB doesn't have cops of its own. It has to go to court to get enforcement powers. Once they're dragged into federal court, they're going to argue against the very legality of the National Labor Relations Act. And they're hoping that Trump-appointed judges will back them up. And frankly, it looks to me like they're hoping for a Trump restoration to ultimately make this go away. That's a really bad look for Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz, who I'd like to remind people all the time, and I wish one reporter would ask her for comment on it, was going to be Hillary Clinton's choice for Department of a Labor Secretary.
And if Howard Schultz got in there, what would we see as a result of him heading the Labor Department?
Oh, we would see nothing as good as what's coming out of the Biden administration, to be clear. I mean, with this background, I mean, he clearly wouldn't have been a pro-union Secretary of Labor. He probably wouldn't have been another Secretary of Labor who would have said, you know, take out a bunch of expensive student loans, go to college, it's a knowledge economy, blah, blah, blah. But he wouldn't have lifted a finger to help workers in this country. That much is clear. And it's just an indictment of the entire Hillary Clinton approach to her campaign, and to her philosophy of governance, and it's an indictment of the media ecosystem that continues to interview her so that she can crap on the squad and on Bernie and complain about, you know, how people didn't get her right at the time. Meanwhile, this is the easiest layup in the world. Your choice for Secretary of Labor is trying to undo all of labor law by appealing to Trump's judges.
Yeah, it's amazing. Well, we got a good guy in the Labor Department now, in Marty Walsh. And I was talking about this at the beginning of the show. They're going to do a special ceremony tomorrow at the Department of Labor to honor essential workers. And think about that. I mean, when in American history did we have a labor secretary that went the distance to honor the workers that were on the front line and are still on the front line in the pandemic? Do you have any recollection of that, Sean?
Well, I mean, you know, historically, actually, the Secretary of Labor was generally picked from the ranks of labor. Republicans and Democrats chose union leaders to be at that cabinet-level position. That changed up, I think, maybe it was Carter. And we really were putting up with a bunch of nonsense in terms of the kind of labor secretaries that were being picked by Clinton and by Obama. bureaucrats, technocrats, again, people that were pushing this sort of go to college and graduate from the working class, essentially, instead of seeing their job as carrying the federal mandate to encourage the practice of collective bargaining, and to crack down on employers that are closing stores to avoid unionization or what have you. This is a bit of a restoration to what it should have been, what it has always been. Even Nixon picked a union leader to be his Secretary of Labor.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Well, yeah, Nixon would be kicked out of office today, especially in the Republican Party if he were to be around. But times have definitely changed.
Yeah.
No home at all. Reagan, too. You could put him in that category as well. Sean, I want to talk about the state of California. Apparently, they call this AB 257. And the vote was this week, 21-12. And I believe the governor is going to sign it. It's called the Fast Recovery Act. And it would make major changes for fast food workers in California. It's my understanding you've been following this. Can you give us some details on what's transpiring here?
Well, I mean, there were a bunch of amendments at the last minute. So what is actually in the law right now, I can't speak to. But the principle and the theory of this is it's a form of sectoral bargaining. It's a form of let's get the rules to apply to every company in an industry across the board and then take those issues out of competition. It's sort of a back to the future kind of strategy, because this was the entire thrust of Franklin Roosevelt's first New Deal, his first couple of years in office before the National Labor Relations Act was passed, before we had the Fair Labor Standards Act. We had the National Industrial Recovery Act, which was an effort to get out of the Great Depression by allowing employers to collude over prices and marketing practices. And as a part of that, they had to collude over over labor standards. And in that part of the process, they created a tripartite system of sort of adjudication of labor standards, where the employers had their representatives. The unions that were involved, there were several unions in an industry claiming a stake, and several unions got a seat at the table. And then there was this sort of nebulous third category of the public, which was generally, it was people from like the Consumers Union or things like that. And the three of them met and did a form of bargaining over what was going to be the minimum wage for that industry, what were going to be the maximum hours, maybe other kinds of working standards, like are there going to be split shifts? Are there going to be, in the case of in a more modern example, clopins, which happens in retail a lot. You close the night before, and then you're asked to come back in and open in the morning, so you only really had like 4 hours off.
Right.
Whatever was decided would then be the minimum standard across an entire industry, and therefore kept those issues out of competition. Right? If the minimum wage in an entire industry is $15, if clopins can't happen in the entire industry, if an entire industry has to schedule workers out 2 weeks in advance, then nobody has a competitive advantage by not having to follow that. Everybody has to follow that. So whatever headaches that creates for you, you got to hire an extra manager, you got to hire five extra people, so that you have the coverage for inevitable call-outs and turnover. Everybody's got to do that. Everybody's got to bear that cost. So it doesn't affect your competitiveness against the other companies. It might affect your bottom line, but it affects everybody's bottom line in a similar way. So that's the theory of it. And the roots of this are actually that state-level laws like this remained on the books. Because the National Industrial Recovery Act, of course, is famously overturned by the Supreme Court, which is what gets Roosevelt to want to try to pack the court. And the laws that replace it are rooted, their constitutionality is rooted in Congress's authority to regulate commerce between the states, which was defined much more narrowly back then. So a hotel existing entirely within the borders of a state was not considered interstate commerce. A McDonald's store, a single individual McDonald's store, would not be considered interstate commerce under that old framework. And so a lot of states created their own laws to pick up what was left behind by the federal law. And when SEIU was organizing in fast food for the Fight for 15 in New York, And they actually got Governor Cuomo to engage on this question. Somebody noticed that New York State's old tripartite bargaining minimum wage law was still on the books and could be used to address the fast food industry in New York State. And when they discovered this about 10 years ago, you know, the fix was not in. This is Andrew Cuomo. There was no guarantee he was going to agree to a $15 minimum wage. In fact, he wouldn't. He would only agree to it if the industry would agree to it. But the process of doing these hearings all across the state and having workers testify about the impact on their lives, the low wages and the scheduling issues, it changed the minds of enough of the public members of the board, Cuomo's people, that it put some pressure on the industry, and they actually agreed to get to $15 at some point, right? It was New York City would get it sooner, the rest of the state would get it later, but they won the minimum wage. And for SEIU, who did not go into that process as a true believer, they went into that process thinking we could get stabbed in the back, came out of it a true believer in that tripartite sectoral bargaining framework. And so SEIU is one of the big backers of this California bill, and I hope it might be the wave of the future. It is a much better framework than what we call enterprise bargaining, which is the idea that you only have a union at your workplace if workers at some point in the past voted for the union and they've managed to maintain a contract. But all you can do is affect the conditions at your one job so that, you know, if you organize the competitor, they might shut down their location and relocate or subcontract or offshore the work, which is what we have when unionization is this high stakes, all or nothing, workplace by workplace sort of choice, instead of right. applying these terms across an entire industry and taking it out of taking the issues out of competition.
That's pretty amazing. So you organize, say, a McDonald's, and then Wendy's, Arby's, all the other chains, Burger King, they would see the same increase in wages, and that's what sectoral bargaining is all about. That's definitely one to watch. Well, I knew I'd get a history lesson out of you, Mr. Richmond. I mean, you're always good when you come to the table, especially at the last minute, so I appreciate your analysis. Any big plans for Labor Day this weekend?
I'm probably going to sit in a Starbucks and join a little light protest, a little boycott with my comrades on Staten Island.
You take care. Stay safe, my brother, okay?
All right. Take care.
Sean Richmond, labor expert, professor of labor studies at the State University of New York. That's it for another edition of America's Workforce. Come